So I'm actually going to be co-moderating with Colin McClay at the Berkman Center, who was a help in organizing this. And unless you have anything to say, we'll just get started.
No, I think we'll just right into it.
So we've already heard from Joe and Ben, but we'll start with Ben and then Joe and then Chris Chitsa-Mihai and then Q&A.
Hi everyone. My name is Ben Wicker. I'm with avaz.org. And as soon as the keynote. Yeah, you know, Winston Churchill's always been entrenched in
So,
as it loads, Winston Churchill, let me start by telling you what Winston Churchill once said about public speaking. Winston Churchill said about public speaking, say what you're going to say, say it, and then say what you just said. And that's what Winston Churchill once said about public speaking. All right, well, that dispatches with my first slide, which is a picture of Winston Churchill. So I'll just preemptively move to the next one, which is a picture of the Avaz logo. So I'm going to talk about what Avaz is, what it does, and what it means. And skipping to the end, I'll say that Avaz as a word, it's not actually an acronym. It means voice in a bunch of languages. Farsi, Dari, means voice, song, action in Turkish, Hindi, Urdu, a whole bunch of languages around the world. And to show you what we are, I'll tell by showing, by running through a few different campaigns. First of all, Zimbabwe. So Avaz is basically an email-centric organizing organization. And this is an example of an email you might get in your inbox about Zimbabwe. In this case, in 2008, last spring, an arms shipment from China to Zimbabwe during this crackdown on the democracy movement was bound for the port in South Africa, and dock workers refused to unload the shipment of weapons. And it sparked a sort of international focus on what was happening in Zimbabwe, and there was this question of what was going to happen. South Africa's government had been rather too friendly with Mugabe's government in Zimbabwe. So we emailed our members to rally support, and we also, in particular, we email their members globally, and we also email their members in coastal African countries in the region to try to connect to basically other dock workers and trade unions to help organize the sort of opposition to unloading these weapons. And eventually, dock workers all along the coast did refuse to organize the weapons, and the shipment was sent back to China, which was certainly a symbolic victory, something of a substantive victory, but of course, you know, Mugabe's still in some kind of power. We can go into that later. But essentially, we use email for as our basic tool of organizing. And to a lot of the discussion that's been happening, email is a very powerful vehicle for narratives. And Avaz, which organizes people all around the world, in most of our messages, we both speak to this particular moment about something that's happening and what it is that a person receiving this message can do to try to change it, and also to the broader movement and what's going on and why this all, what's the point of this whole thing, grounded in values. So this is the one long piece of text I'll subject you to. At the end of that email about Zimbabwe, it said, "This crisis has many layers and raises issues that range from the legacy of colonialism to the uncontrolled international arms trade. At the heart of it is the simple idea that every human life is equally precious and that every person has rights. The people of Zimbabwe took their stand in the voting booth. The dock workers of South Africa took their stand at the harbor. Now, even if we can only offer a click, it's time to do our part as well." And clicking through took me to this page on this campaign. I was just working with a whole coalition of different groups. We just raised money from our members to fly a huge banner over the United Nations when South Africa's president visited for a UN Security Council meeting, which the next day triggered a response, a slight shift in South Africa's position, urging respect for democracy in Zimbabwe. And essentially, you know, VOD members are all over the world, and they speak many different languages. VOD is in 14 different languages. But, you know, as we talked earlier about human rights, there are certain norms and values and ideas that have tremendous appeal in every region of the world now, and that's the language that Abbas speaks. And what we found is that it's possible, essentially, to bring together a community of people when we've identified an opportunity for change, when we've identified a way that people can have an impact on that, on a problem that they care about, rooted in those values. It's possible to kind of quickly use networks to funnel selective action in a sometimes effective way. So Burma is a second example. This was a huge people power moment. This is a photo from the monks' protests in fall of 2007. And when the monks started, you know, walking in the streets to protest the explosion of the price of food, we were flooded with messages from our members asking us to do something. So we started with a petition, which grew to 760,000 people by this moment. We presented here to Gordon Brown. It was a petition to the UN Security Council asking them to basically take steps to push the regime, and specifically of China, which is blocking UN Security Council action. Now, petitions themselves are, you know, for people who sign them, it can be expressive. The power of in some countries, petitions, if they're big enough, become legally binding. But at a global level, and often on a national level, petitions are essentially vehicles for activism that uses theater. And so presenting a public leader with a petition that supports a stand they're taking is a way that they can basically claim legitimacy from popular mandate for something good they're doing. Or throwing a petition at somebody who it's against is a way of shaming them. My favorite petition delivery of all time was, I think it was Nas, the rapper, took a petition against Fox News racism onto the Colbert Report. And Colbert, you know, had a long conversation with him about it. And it's basically a, you know, the more people sign a petition, the more it creates this opportunity to do something with it. And Abbas has a very strong aversion to petitions to nowhere, which are these phenomena you encounter a lot, where if someone has a petition that's really just because they want to say something, but there's no plan to use it to have an effect. And partly because we try to have an effect, I think people sign a lot of petitions. Now, one of the things that happens with petitions, I think 500,000 or something people joined the Abbas network during the Burma petition campaign. Some months later, there was the cyclone in Burma, and it was a horrendous disaster, and the government refused to let foreign aid workers into the country. Now, Abbas, through the advocacy work the previous year, had built relationships with the Burmese monk networks, and this video on one side of the screen is the head of the International Burmese Monks Organization asking for funds, because the monks in Burma essentially became the only aid workers doing real work there. So people were seeking shelter in monasteries. The monks were helping with food and medicine wherever they could. They had almost no money, and there were no aid workers getting in. So we emailed our members, and in about 10 days raised $2 million, and were able to transfer it to the monks organizations, who were able to distribute it two monasteries within the country very quickly, using kind of a traditional banking system called the Handi system. You know, at the same time, as many aid workers were waiting on the borders for visas to get into the country. And that's the kind of, that's another side of what online organizing can do, is very rapidly raise resources when there's a way to get through, and to do it to kind of bypassing traditional formal structures. Climate change is the area where we pull our members constantly to identify priorities for our work. Climate change, no matter whether you join the Abbas network through Burma or Zimbabwe or Guantanamo or whatever issue, time and again we find that climate change is the highest priority for our members in every region of the world. And we've use the sort of whole spectrum of campaigning things, but in particular, we run a lot of ads at international climate summits, like this one that we ran at the Bali summit. So this ad, sort of political satire of the Titanic movie poster, and I'm not sure whether Bush noticed or heard about it or whatever, but Harper and Caputo both very much did. And in the final moments of that summit, both leaders' governments caved. Canada, where I think 1% of the population had signed a petition urging support for targets for 2020 for carbon reduction. The opposition leader recorded a video saying, "You of Oz people, this is what democracy is." I can't do a French accent. And then in Japan, you can see the photo from the newspaper Asahi Shimbun, which is it's the second biggest paper in Japan. They reported the story that apparently the environment minister waved the copy of the ad at a cabinet meeting and said to the prime minister, "Is this how we want the world to see us? Blocking action on climate change." It didn't mention standing next to Bush. But essentially, this ad was paid for by Oz members. It was conveying this message signed by 50,000 people around the world in a couple of days. And similar ads, this one from the G8 summit, and this one targeting Germany at the climate negotiations in Poznan, are ways to basically, that we work to channel this urgent request from our members for action on climate change into pointed political pressure that can move leaders at moments, decision-making moments that will have real consequences. To transition to the next section, I'll talk briefly about Tibet. During the crackdown in 2008 in the spring, the Chinese government had engaged in violence in Tibet. We had a strong response from our membership. We did polling, consulted experts, and came up with a call for dialogue with the Dalai Lama as a crucial thing, not independence for Tibet, but specifically to engage in constructive dialogue. And found enormous support from our members, and it really exploded across the world. So this petition grew to 1.5 million people, and then we created a wiki and helped our members plug into Tibet organizations around the world that protested outside of 84 Chinese embassies, and created and brought these petitions and sent this message for dialogue. But we wanted to sort of keep going with it. That over the course of 2008, there was this question of what to do about the Olympics, and some groups were calling for Olympic boycotts or Olympic disruptions. And when we polled our members and talked to our members in China and elsewhere, we basically found that that taking that kind of tack would be counterproductive. That China was not going to respond to that kind of outside pressure, but rather pushing forward this idea of dialogue and handshakes, and coming together. Was the note that would strike that could possibly have the best effect. So that video was the handshake that started with the Dalai Lama. And this is a photo from Jordan. We asked our members around the world to shake hands, basically, and upload the photos. And we wound up having, I think, 200,000 people join the virtual handshake, many of them sending photos. And we actually channeled the handshake, like we mapped the sequence of signers and channeled it all the way around the world to someone who shook hands with a government official who then shook hands with the Chinese president, although I don't think they knew that they were receiving the Dalai Lama's handshake at the time. So those are a few examples of campaigns. What Oz is, or aspires to be, is the world in action. It's a forum for people everywhere to take action on issues of global concern, where there's a democratic deficit, where there's a broad consensus about something that should be done, and yet international institutions, as they are failing to do it. And while there are many controversial issues in the world, a lot of the biggest things, there's actually a surprising amount of consensus. And to take one example, in Israel and Palestine, surely one of the most traded, heavy, intense, emotional, controversial sort of places in the world, actually. Most people around the world, and most of the time, most people in Israel and Palestine support a two-state solution. And that's the fact that all the things that prevent therefore being a two-state solution, many of which are very real, obscure the fact that there isn't, that most people want this basic thing to advance. And what Abbas does is looks for those areas of public consensus and looks for opportunities to advance those on things that matter. We've grown entirely from people sending emails to each other. So we've never taken out advertising. It's all, people, we send an email, someone passes it along, someone else signs up. And since we launched formally in the beginning of 2007, after kind of a pre-launch in 2006, and are now at 3.5 million members worldwide. This is a map, 90% of our membership is outside the United States. This map is the world shaded into deciles by the percent of the internet using population in each country that are Abbas subscribers. So you can see in some countries, we have more than 1% of the internet using population are members of Abbas. France is both the greatest density and the greatest number, I believe. Singapore, Bhutan actually were a pretty decent chunk. The absolute numbers map is obviously different because population, the absolute number of people we have is looks different from the fraction of people who are in particular places. But this gives a sense of kind of where the community is strongest, and this doesn't reflect, this was made in January, and since then we've actually had very rapid growth in South Africa and India, as well as further growth in Canada, so that the shades would be a little bit different. This is the staff. It's a group of about 20, depending on the moment, I guess I should say, maybe 18 to 30 people around the world. The current campaigns team is around 12. And we're a virtual team, so we collaborate through Skype and video. And that says a couple of things. One, in Wendy Wong's presentation, she talked about how relatively centralized decision-making structures allow organizations to move very quickly. And Abbas says that. But the other thing is that actually, as a group of 12 campaigning people, we don't have that much power to do any particular thing. All the power of Abbas comes from our members. And so for us to run successful campaigns requires us to stay in close dialogue with our membership, which means running polls. We run often several in a week, both in the areas where particular things are happening, like in Congo or Pakistan or wherever, and also the global membership to identify priorities. We look for opportunities, we work extensively with partners, identify campaigns, come up with theories of change in which our members can have make an impact. And then finally, we test our campaigns. And if something, even if it has the best of intentions and ideas going in, if we actually find that our members don't respond to it, we won't run it. And in a sense, our membership is the beginning and the end of the campaign process. And when our members do respond, enormous things are possible from a relatively small base of operations. So in brief, I think the conclusions to draw from what we do, and also the model that we're working from, Abbas borrowed a lot of its kind of organizational DNA from MoveOn.org in the US and from a group called GetUp in Australia, which is larger than MoveOn in terms of percentage of the population there. And each of these groups each of these groups takes a few different ideas. One is that what works online is what would work offline. So people do things because of values that don't magically appear when they sit at their computers. They do things because of values that they have inside them, and they're convinced by arguments that they would be convinced by offline as well. And the internet happens to make it easier. It reduces friction in a sense. It makes it easier to reach many people at once. It makes it easier to collect things across broad geography. But there's no magical ingredient that putting a boring video on YouTube turns it into an interesting video, or asking people to do something by email makes them want to do something that they would never do if you asked them in person. Essentially, the internet is a forum for organizing. It's been said the internet is a series of tubes. So part of what online activists and online organizers do is try to make good, thick, sturdy tubes that are pointing in the right direction. could say. Civil society, global civil society, to some extent, historically, has been a series of tubs. And by that I mean there are these different kind of vessels or collection points that have brought together communities of people concerned about particular issues. So the climate movement is a great example. There are wonderful groups that have, you know, large numbers of supporters that are concerned about climate change and the environment. And they're separate largely from groups that work on Burma or Zimbabwe or poverty or any of these other issues. And so what we try to do, this is an illustration you can see made by a team of specialists. We essentially work to connect the tubes and the tubs and point them at the fires that are happening at a particular moment. Most people, the metaphor is actually terrible because most people would belong in many of these tubs at once. Most people don't think of themselves as environmentalists, they think of themselves as humans. And you know, we kind of create easy ways for people to participate in specific campaigns. And a lot of the types of things that people have been talking about do similar work. So this is not the goal of creating one big tub where everyone is collected and then they point out of that. It's rather to create many big tubs and little tubs and new tubes and create lots of ways, essentially. An idea from MoveOn is that if you're an online organizer or any kind of organizer, you're like a person standing in the corner of a crowded room at a party. And you're trying to maybe yell or maybe at least be interesting enough that people will pay attention to what you're doing for a second. You don't have much of their time. But you can't, don't imagine that you've captured them in some way. Don't imagine that you're the center of their world. Rather, you know, recognize the fact that you're one of 100 messages in their inbox or one conversation that they're having in the course of a week. And offer people, you know, meaningful things to do that they can take the lead, but offer people a chance to do something that helps them live up to the kind of person that they want to be or to live in the kind of world they want to live in. And the old system where people were essentially treated like customers who were spending a scarce resource, and the goal would be to kind of, the old kind of silos of different issue areas and campaigns that would require people to be engaged with a large and increasing part of their time over years or decades, that model made sense given the tools that used to be available. And using that model, movements have had incredible successes from civil rights to the anti-apartheid movement to banning landmines, anti-poverty movement, you know, a whole range of things. That kind of organizing remains critical. But there's a new opportunity now that I think technology facilitates to allow a larger group of people to also plug in frequently and to make part of what they do every week or every month to contribute just a little bit in a way that can be aggregated quickly and can make a really powerful difference around the world. There was a question earlier about whether this just gives more power to the already powerful. And I think the answer is, it probably does give a little more power to the already powerful. I think it also gives a lot more power to the not that powerful. And it gives some more power to people who are, you know, largely powerless in the old system. But the biggest thing it does is it increases the amount of power, it increases the amount of collective action potential that people can engage in. And I think that that's the most exciting thing about this, that, you know, there's so much to do in this world. And creating new models and creating better ways to leverage social networks and build social movements to do more of the stuff that needs doing, I think is, in a broad sense, what's possible, and we probably can't ask for it to do too much more than that. Although it'll be nice when I can flip this vertically. So the answer to the questions that have been asked today is yes. I would argue that you can use social network theory to construct a model and then have it work. There was a question of whether people are just looking at models that do work and saying, and then looking at their structure. Actually, you know, Avaaz was created based on thinking through all this stuff, and I know several other groups that were as well. And so the theory actually does inform practice successfully. Secondly, does analyzing social networks just describe an existing power structure, or does it actually create ways to change those power structures? I'd say the answer is yes, it does create ways to change them. Is narrative crucial? Yes. Does video help? Yes. Does video cure everything? No. So that would not be a yes. I'll just move on past that.
Is a slide in all of your presentations the answer to yes? Is that only in certain?
Yes. So in summary, Churchill, what Abbas does is means, and I'll end with the summary. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. My name is Joe Green. I'm the founder of Causes. For those who don't know what Causes is basically a set of tools on Facebook and MySpace for people to organize. We have about 50 million people that use Causes. There's over 250,000 different causes. We've raised about $7 million so far for charity. Our average donation size is $22. What I wanted to talk about a little bit is to kind of go back for a minute and think about, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, social movements online and what opportunity really is provided by social networking. Like, what is Facebook, MySpace, maybe to a lesser extent, what do these things mean? Not just for organizing, but what do they mean in general? So my background is as a grassroots organizer, working for political campaigns, labor unions. I was an undergrad here at Harvard not very many years ago, so it's nice to be back. And I was roommates with the guys who founded Facebook and worked on Facebook pretty early, but made the decision to instead go off to the Kerry campaign and lose two different states. So Mark Zuckerberg calls this the billion-dollar mistake. And so I wanted to start with asking the question of why does Facebook matter? I think it's gotten enormous. It's 200 million people. That's a lot of people, and that's 200 million in real people. So I, you know, just the reason that it matters is this is the internet getting real. And what do I mean by that? You know, if you think about kind of the development of the internet, for most of the history of the internet, community online has been very pseudonymous. Community online was people in a Usenet group who were Star Wars fans getting together, and their identity was Boba Fett 12, or, you know, Luke Skywalker 45, or whatever. They were not themselves. And real identity online has been this holy grail for a really long time. And there were lots of huge attempts that were spectacular failures, from Microsoft Passport to AOL Magic Carpet, I don't know if anybody remembers these, where tens of millions of dollars were put in by large companies to try to set up online identities. And the approach to this was, we're going to basically issue you like an online ID card from a verified third party. You're going to give us your credit card number or some verifying piece of information, and we will issue you an identity. Well, nobody did that. What instead has happened, which is, I think, completely unpredictable to most people, is that Facebook profiles have become an identity. And nobody, no single third party says, Ben Winkler's, he's over here now, Ben's Facebook profile is him. But when I look at it, I know it's him. Well, why do I know it's him? Well, I look at our friends in common. I went to college with his wife. And so it turns out that, so I see, okay, if Beth, formerly McCarthy, now Winkler, is friends with him. And I look at photos, and I see photos of him and Beth. I'm like, well, this is probably the Ben Winkler that I'm thinking of. And if you think about it, it's actually much harder to fake that than it is to fake an ID. Like, it'd be much harder for me to convince Beth that I was Ben than for me to get a driver's license that says my name is Ben Winkler. Like, I could do that for $70 on Blair Street in Los Angeles, to make a West Coast reference. Or, you know, in any American city, I could get a driver's license that's fairly passable to convince people I'm Ben. But I'm not going to convince his social relations that I'm Ben. So you've got real identity, and you've got that real identity connected up to people. So you've got a representation of what folks at Facebook like to call the social graph, which is a nerdy reference to mathematical graph theory. Basically just saying there are nodes and there are connections between nodes. People being the nodes, these connections being their friendships, their relationships. And now we have that represent online. What does that allow? That allows real world social dynamics to be brought onto the internet for the first time ever. I mean, for those of you who did not grow up online, the older set in the room, you know, for a lot of history, and I think frankly a lot of people still think of the internet as this separate thing. It's like you have your like online existence and your offline existence. But because of social networking, those are no longer distinct. People think of the internet like they think of their phone, their BlackBerry, whatever. It's a tool, it's a way to connect. It is not a separate like space or place within which you live, which is how the internet used to be thought of. So what does this allow us to do? Well, I want to give an example that has nothing to do with social activism, which is the story of Facebook launching their photos feature. So all of you guys have seen photos on Facebook. The number of photos on Facebook is 10 times larger than, it's twice as large as pretty much as the top 10 photo applications combined. Flickr, PhotoBucket, all of them. The number of photos is massive. So when Facebook decided to launch their photo feature, there was a lot of resistance because there were a lot of like the pre-named sites that already had photos online. But what the key thing that Facebook did was the friend tagging in photos. So those of you who have used photos on Facebook, you upload a photo and you tag your friends in it. Well, why is that a good idea? Well, most people in their life, the way they use photos is they're not a photographer. They don't take pictures of trees or pretty rocks and put them online and appreciate them as art. That's a cool thing to do, and that's what some set of people do. But most people's use of photos is they take pictures of their friends, and the old model is you put them in a photo album. When people came over, you drag out the photo album, and you make people look at it. And you have this sort of social experience around the photos that have some common meaning to you. So, you know, the family comes over, we should show photos of, you know, the latest family event and kind of catch people up, or your son's graduation or whatever. Well, when they did photos on Facebook, they were missing most of the photo functionality. The resolution sucked. There was no way to edit photos. You couldn't reorder albums. You couldn't crop photos. And you couldn't do almost anything except tag your friends. You upload a photo, I say, oh, Ben's in this photo and other Ben's in this photo. And they get that photo and it's relevant to them. So that simple single thing of bringing something very basic to people like photo sharing and putting it on the social network made it orders of magnitude more powerful than it was before. So I say that because I think the same is true of organizing. In that organizing offline, I mean, I took a class from Marshall when I was here, and he's been a big influence to me, and I talk about him all the time. And the kind of organizing that he has taught to tens of thousands of campaign organizers and tens of thousands of labor organizers is fundamentally based upon relationships. You start your organization, but, you know, Cesar Chavez started one person at a time, one farm worker at a time, doing the next to impossible, which is convincing extremely powerless people that they could have collective power. And he did that based on conversations and based on, say, okay, you invite 20 of your friends over, we're going to have a house meeting, and then a couple of those people will have their own house meeting with their own friends. And we not only grow the organization that way, but we also maintain strength in the organization that way. Because, you know, if I am trying to get you this real-life example, I organized for John Kerry in rural Arizona, which I don't recommend to people, and including, you know, where the polygamists live. And, you know, if you're trying to get someone to show up at 7 in the morning on a Sunday when it's already 105 degrees outside, whether or not they care about John Kerry, even whether or not they care about Barack Obama, it has very little to do with it. What it has to do with whether or not they turn their alarm off is someone else that I know going to be there and going to be disappointed that I didn't show up? Like, am I going to get crap from my friend because I didn't show up? That's the real kind of social pressure that allows things to get done. And so you can now take those same principles and bring them online. So that's sort of point one. Why does Facebook matter? Point two, how does Facebook work? And what I mean by that is, why do people actually use it? So there's a lot of potential answers to the question, but one I'm going to focus on what I like to call social validation. So Facebook is, you know, sort of dirty little secret is Facebook is very deliberately designed for these social validation interactions. So I spend a little bit of time and put up a little bit of content, and I get a positive reaction back. It's basically like all the good things about social interactions in middle school and none of the bad things. So I put up a photo, and people say, oh, you look so cute in that dress. Or, you know, I put up a comment, and people comment on that. Hi, Beth. So my favorite example of this is what happens on people's birthday on Facebook. So on your birthday on Facebook, everybody writes on your wall, publicly on your profile. This is really bizarre, if you think about it, right? There's no existing social pattern that this is based on.
pre-Facebook, when it was your birthday, I did not wander down the hallways yelling, hey, happy birthday! That would just be, like, bizarre. I would, you know, wish you happy birthday sort of privately. I might come to the birthday party. So why do people do that? Well, one, it's become a social convention so that I feel like a jerk if I don't wish you happy birthday publicly on your profile. And two, I do it because I want to make sure on my birthday that everyone else does. The analogy I draw is, like, if you guys remember when you were in elementary school, Valentine's Day was basically this big pissing contest about who got the most Valentines, who had the highest pile on their desk. And that was a measure of kind of your social stature, was, okay, did I get, like, a huge pile of Valentines, or I personally get, like, a little tiny pile of Valentines? And the most popular kids are the biggest pile and the most flowers and the most boxes of candy and whatnot. And so Facebook is ultimately about, and the reason people are so addicted to it, the reason people, you know, representing your identity and having conversations and these things are important, but you can represent your identity and never check back. Like LinkedIn, you represent your identity, but you're almost never there. The reason people are on hours and hours a day is because they get that social reinforcement, that social validation. Well, guess what? Organizing is also all about social validation. It is all, you know, good organizing. You know, you feel silly as a political organizer putting a poster on the wall for your 75-year-old volunteers and putting gold stars next to the ones that have made the most phone calls. But guess what? It works. And the reason it works is because they are getting social validation, really simple stuff, within a group of people that they care about. It's not just social validation to random people. It is social validation to people you care about. So, like, for example, on Facebook Causes, we show how much money you've raised, how many people you've recruited to your causes on your profile. And you care about that being there because it's seen by the people you care about. And so you are accountable and you get credit for the good things that you've done in this sort of what I call semi-public way. It's not public in the sense that everybody can see it. It's public in the sense that the people you care about can see it. And so this then allows organizing in a decentralized way to come online. Which brings me to my third point, which is a point about changes in social capital. So, you know, this is a crowd that's probably, you know, familiar with the sort of bowling alone sort of decline of social capital thesis. Everybody familiar with that? Anybody? Yeah, okay. So the point there is that, you know, membership in voluntary organizations has declined drastically since late 60s, early 70s, when basically everything in the United States went to shit. You know, any basic metric you look at of, like, solidarity, inequality, et cetera, all kind of went to hell in, like, the late 60s, early 70s for some variety of reasons. But that affected all sorts of organizations, including nonprofits. So nonprofits made this transformation from chapter-based organizations that raised money, raised awareness, got people to do stuff based on local chapters, to sort of direct marketing organizations, where they basically, like the big nonprofits today, they spend a whole buttload of money, often 30 or 40% of what they bring in, marketing, sending out direct mail, phone, to some degree email these days, very, very top-down. They're not really asking, unlike what Ben's doing, they're not asking their members sort of what should we do, they're just deciding and then sort of, so your relationship with the nonprofit is very, very siloed. And that leads to a couple problems. One is just plain inefficient because it's very expensive to raise money and to do things. Two is that people are not very engaged. Your affiliation with the organization is like you get the newsletter once a month or you get emails from them and you send a check in every year. And that's like about it. Thirdly, is it creates this very unequal playing field between nonprofits. So if you're a small nonprofit trying to get started and raise money, it's really hard to do because all the traditional ways of raising money, like direct mail, are really expensive. And you have to pay millions of dollars to put a direct mail campaign together to even start with, to even get any return on it, much less to make money on it. And finally, it locks out younger people because if you're, like most young people, you don't have a landline, you don't have a mailing address that anybody knows about, unless you go to Harvard because they publish your mailing address to everybody and then you get tons of crap in it. And also your phone number, apparently. So folks who are younger or just don't have much money are kind of locked out because it's not worth, someone's going to give you $20 or someone's young, it's just not worth reaching out to them. So the difference, what's changing, and Ben got at this, is that now it has become, A, really easy to get lots of people to join stuff. My co-founder, Sean Parker, co-founded Napster and then co-founded a company called Plaxo, which some of you have heard of. It was sort of the address book aggregator, was also kind of annoying because it was really good at viral, at getting things to spread viral. And we have sort of taken that to an art or a science, whichever you want to call it, where making it super, super easy to promote your cause and making it really effective to get lots and lots of people to join. And then, hopefully, we have a lot of examples of successful action that have been taken, where people can then socially pressure their friends. And so now that you have a means to get social recognition in a way that matters to you, which is crucial to getting back to sort of this pre-collapse of social capital world where things are much more relationship-based, where if I, you know, I'm incentivized to do something for my cause because, you know, I get credit for it. And that's not meaning to sound cynical about people's, like, good nature. I think people do want to do something good, but they're more likely to do it if they get social credit for it. And you see the desire to do things in that way, and in these sort of random things that happen. For my favorite example of this is the charity marathon model, right? Pick your disease, pick your method of getting around, boat, running, walking, you know, whatever, and there's probably some sort of event for it. Why does this work? Well, it initially doesn't really make any sense in that running around San Francisco has nothing to do with cancer. Like, I'm not going to find a cure for cancer in a duffel bag in Golden Gate Park. I probably should make a Boston reference there, in Boston Common. But what it does do is it gives me an excuse to hit up my friends for money. Right? It gives an excuse to go to my friends and be like, dude, I'm running this marathon. You should run it with me. And they're like, eh, I'm too lazy. And they're like, well, maybe you can give me $30 instead for this great cause. But it allows you to unlock those social relationships. Well, we can now have that happen in a much cheaper, much easier way where anyone can start causes. Anybody can have their issue and ask friends. Like, as an example, we've adapted that to what we call birthday wishes, where we've had this feature which is starting to really take off, where on your birthday, you pick a charity and you ask your friends to donate to that charity. Really simple excuse to hit up your friends for money. But now because it's on a social network, it's easy to get people to do it, to grow it, et cetera. So I'm going to leave it there. Lots of other things I can talk about, but trying to keep to about 15 minutes. Thank you.
Hi, so I'm Chris Xenbihai. I'm coming from MIT, and instead of Winston Churchill, I'll show a typical MIT job board. So if you're a graduating undergraduate and you're looking for a job opportunity, there are these regular kind of talks on campus. And this one reminded me of a Bill Staples talk that I heard one time where he did a kind of a fictional discussion between the founder of Amazon and John Poindexter when he was working for the NSA. And he did it entirely by taking quotes that they'd said in different public formats and putting them together to show just how on the same page they were in their understanding of their desire for really good modeling of social networks and user personality profiles online. That's almost all I'll say about that, but it is interesting. One of the strategies of my research group at MIT is always to take a look at essentially follow the money when it comes to new technologies. And, you know, for a decade, some of the biggest researchers in social networking, online social networking, have been the NSA and other kind of intelligence organizations. The relationship of the money and how the technologies end up is complicated. But, you know, it is something to think about as we talk about these online social networks. What I'm going to be talking about is a different kind of social network, I think, and these are ones that are based on geographic locations. I am the director right now at MIT of a research center called the Center for Future Civic Media, and we're committed to trying to think through, we're essentially funded by former newspapermen who are worried about the death of the newspaper, because newspapers were a great way for a community to find out, investigate, represent its interests, and portray these interests to its members. One of the ways they were able to do that, of course, was through personal ads as well as corporate ads or commercial ads. So that kind of function is missing. When we started the center, my research group, which always kind of focuses on confrontational technologies or technologies for kind of radical social change, we decided that we would try to take one of the most difficult situations we could imagine about how a geographic community can represent its own interests and forward its own interests. Probably one of the most difficult places would be, you know, Chechnya the Niger Delta. Because of the limitations of our funding, we had to pick something happening in the United States. So we decided to pick a set of communities which are under tremendous threat from the outside to try to understand how we could affect social change within those communities. So, you know, one of the people that we've thought about in reference to this is Manuel Casals, who has this idea of the relative importance of communities and politics now and 100 years ago. And one of the things he points out in globalism is that, you know, while the political initiative of a movement like the Burma movement, you know, or many kind of movements that happen politically, political identity and often tools for political action are grounded at the geographic level. But in fact, many of the kinds of things that influence people day to day happen not at the global level, not at the local level, but are actually kind of global changes. So your city is responding to state and federal changes. Capital markets will dramatically affect local businesses. Labor in China will affect the prices of goods that you've become used to at Walmart. All of these kind of global changes will have often the most profound effects that happen in a local community. And local communities often lack the ability to confront those global challenges, which of course makes sense. I mean, they're tiny. Hurricane Katrina had a lot of energy. You know, these things are kind of difficult to balance against each other. But what it's left is, in many cases, I think a little bit of an over-focus on, if we think about the repertoires of social change, one of the really great kind of changes in the repertoire in the 19th century was this idea of a international or global petition, often carried out through the popular media or the kind of new newspaper industry. And this remains a really, you know, powerful thing, and you guys, I think, are kind of focused on that repertoire a lot, this idea of kind of the global petition, especially in the case of Zimbabwe. My wife is from Zimbabwe, and she said to say thank you, because she loves your petitions. But people like Cole talk about the leverage that an international movement with lots of publicity happening through the media can have on a government like Mugabe's government. But I have a sense that there are other repertoires out there, and so we've been looking particularly at this question of how a local community can better form collective action to confront one of these global problems, and perhaps collectively act between communities. And because we wanted to really challenge ourselves, we decided to choose communities that have internet penetration in the teens of the population. These are in the United States, but they're largely in rural areas. And this is what it looks like on the ground. That's the MIT logo and fake clouds. But the rest of it isn't Photoshop. And in fact, this is a view that I saw when my wife won't be up over Texas. And these are natural gas wells. And we flew for about 45 minutes at 400 miles an hour over a landscape that largely looked like this, with few holes in between. How many of you have seen natural gas wells or natural gas mining? Where? In Texas. So you usually see the drilling, but after the drilling is done, you don't see much because unlike oil derricks, there often isn't a lot of stuff left on the surface. The gas comes up. I'm going to get into some, very quickly, I hope, into some details about this problem because it's a very interesting problem. We came through it through a kind of an STS person, an anthropologist who's co-directing this project with me, named Sarah Wiley. She's a graduate student in STS at MIT. And she was studying endocrine disruption, you know, these kind of man-made chemicals that mimic estrogen or other hormones within the body that are several orders of magnitude more dangerous than carcinogens or toxicants because they operate on these incredibly small levels. She was actually a scientist working on endocrine disruption until she discovered that the lab subjects were having changes at levels that she was routinely exposed to as a lab worker. So she decided to kind of leave that and go to STS, why many of us are in humanities. And so it turns out that this fracturing process, this is a hydraulic fracturing process by which a company like BP or Shell will come to your community and start creating wells by essentially pressurizing, putting high pressure liquid into the ground until the ground literally explodes into kind of bronchial tunnels through which gas can now flow up in large amounts. For about 70 years, they used diesel fuel for this hydraulic fracturing. Now they use completely proprietary, trade secret protected chemicals, up to 10 million gallons per well. These are the chemicals after they've been pulled up from this process. About 60% are recovered at best, that's the industry reporting. They're considered too hazardous to travel interstate after they've been mixed on site. And so they're left to evaporate in about 20 states in the United States. So what we're looking at is a set of sort of grassroots opposition to this process, often which happen in communities with very little reference to other movements that are happening in other communities. So we're looking at some that are just starting, like this one in the top left is a suburban Ohio organization that started organizing because there were wells being drilled on a private school that some parents' kids went to. They thought this was a little suspicious, so they started their own organization about 2 years ago. And then down at the left is Grand Valley Citizens Alliance, which is about 20 years old and is almost completely dead at this point. Not because the situation hasn't gotten worse for them progressively, it has, but rather because many of the people who founded it have developed rare forms of cancer, have died, presumably because of chemical exposure, have moved if they can. And so what we've seen is a set of kind of grassroots organization where the organizers are really powerless. This is a typical drilling setup, and that's my shoulder, but behind me you'll see a truck set up with several very large workstation computers, satellite communications, and it's relaying in real time what's going on with the fracturing process back to offices in Dallas or Denver typically. How widespread is this issue? Well, it's actually kind of amazing because it's very widespread. This is Colorado alone. Has over 80,000 of these wells that have been drilled so far, and they're estimating another 20,000 over the next 2 to 3 years. That data is old. Obviously, the depression is going to have a huge effect on that number, but if we recover, these are areas that are going to continue to be developed. And you know, as you get closer and closer, you'll see that this actually kind of resolves into a grid. One of the biggest infrastructure projects in current U.S. Industry is developing these underground natural gas pipelines. So it's an incredibly distributed problem. It's a problem that affects people tremendously, in part because most people who live where these wells are being drilled don't have any ability to contest the wells because they don't own the mineral rights in most of the states in the United States, except for a few on the East Coast. They don't really have any way to resist the well being drilled. So you would think that there'd be great opportunities to organize, but what in fact we're finding is it's a really impoverished space for organization. Industry, these are some of the most expensive, wealthy industries in the world. Schlumberger, Halliburton, BP, Shell, on and on, some of the most rich and most profitable companies in the world. And they actively resist this kind of organization in a way that very few kind of targets of organization do resist. Global warming is one example, perhaps recent news about China infiltrating Burmese computers, Burmese and Tibetan computers. So this is a process by which there's a very strong active force resisting these grassroots organizations, capturing local governments, capturing the whole professions. We found, for instance, in Colorado that if you want the EPA to come and take air samples in your community, the EPA is legally required to alert industry 3 days ahead of the air sample. So they'll literally shut down their operations for 3 days until the wind kind of clears most of the pollution away. Lawyers, there's no lawyer in northern New Mexico who will defend surface owners. Basically, they're all on the retainer of industry. So people end up having to go to Colorado or to other states to find a lawyer. So what we've seen is the kind of systematic capture of the sort of agents which would normally help balance differing aspects of society, balance the power of corporations against the power of people. In these rural communities, that's more or less not possible because the amount of money is so great and the collective action of people is relatively low. So what are we doing about it? We're essentially in the middle of a what we're hoping will be a three-year project, essentially trying to come up with tools for community collective action. By community collective action, we're talking about both the community itself, how can we develop tools that help some of these small organizations like San Juan Citizens Alliance or NeoGAP to organize to do their work better. How do we help national organizations that help them do that work better? And how do we get communities to communicate to each other? And I think, you know, one of the amazing things about computers that no one anticipated 10 years ago is that they are becoming primarily a tool of communication. And these guys are at the forefront of that. And but, you know, we're looking at a group of people who don't use Facebook. I don't think we've run into a single member of this community who uses Facebook yet, but and in fact, in some cases, like in one part of rural Colorado, we found that the mail, U.S. mail, is still being delivered twice a day. And so people use the mail kind of regularly in a way that just seems perverse from a Cambridge, Massachusetts perspective. So we've essentially tried to focus on several, I want to show one example of the kind of opposition that happens. When one of these organizations, one of these citizens groups, for instance, noticed that there were large amounts of hydrogen sulfide leaking into their neighborhood. Hydrogen sulfide is a neurotoxin. Several parts per million will begin to cause you to think funny. A couple hundred parts per million will cause permanent brain damage. And this is routinely off-gassed in these, you know, 80,000 wells that I showed. So if you're like a guy named we know named Rick Rawls, who's a goat farmer, who has 40 acres and over 20 wells on those 40 acres. He's routinely exposed to large amounts of hydrogen sulfide. When a neighborhood organization, for instance, will try to stage a protest over that, BP will come and do direct mail campaigns, which of course are very expensive, but they can afford to do, with pamphlets saying, you know, what is hydrogen sulfide? Well, actually, it's the smell in farts. It's in all of our bodies. Of course, if the enzyme that your body uses to break it down dies, you will die within a day, but they don't mention that. So it's very active campaigning against this. So how do we help these communities self-determine, rebalance information and power with industry, and encourage good industry behavior? Because, of course, we're all using this gas. It's one of the cleanest form of energy at the consumption level that we have. It's not going away. So we're essentially trying to do social analysis of the communities and of the groups that are working to affect change and to bring information communication technologies as much as possible into their work. So how do we try to develop information communication technologies that are things that they will find it easier to do their work with than the things that they're doing already? So essentially, we're approaching these different groups, trying to do analysis of the work that they do, how they do that work, and trying to imagine what are small, slim, effective ways that we can kind of develop systems that will allow them to, whatever work they're doing, record it, share it with others, and spread that work larger. How to network communities between each other using a variety of techniques, not just websites, but paper, phone, a variety of other things, and to build essentially a mirror or draw the, as we used to say in my art school, to draw the negative space around industry so that people would have a better idea of what it's doing by essentially drawing its outline by connecting the people who are interpolated by it against their will. So by looking at the sorts of actors and stakeholders that we have, we're developing small applications that work to communicate between them. The biggest piece that we're building is something called Drillwell, which is essentially a piece of software to help people sustain interactions with industry. So many of these people have been dealing with industry for 20, 25 years because of the way the industry works. They are locked in this kind of embrace with it because once drilling happens on your property, your real estate value goes down. We know people who retired and 6 months after moving to Wyoming or Colorado will have 10 wells on their property and they can no longer sell it. That's where all their capital went to. So people have long-term interactions, and I think the, you know, one of the points is that this is a very different kind of social action and incentive than a lot of these global causes, where often, you know, I mean, if you take the classic example of the abolitionist movement of the 19th century, the thing that put the kind of global action on the map. The people who affected a lot of the social change were not slaves. It was relatively rich people who could make lifestyle choices in European countries and the United States. So, you know, so that's the hallmark of that movement, people who are often not directly affected by a cause that there's a lot of agreement on. We're trying to look at what people who are directly affected by it will do. So Drill Well is essentially a kind of a system which allows people to keep track of their interactions, every interaction they have with industry, to document complaints that they have. Right now, most people actually complain to industry about problems with industry. They're encouraged to do so by industry, and they're often encouraged to do so by captured government officials. You know, 5 of the 7 members of the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the regulatory board in Colorado, 5 of 7 members are industry people. You know, so when you call COGCC, you'll often get advice, oh, call the company. And so there's essentially no paper trail or any kind of trail of problems that people are having with this. So we're essentially building simple ways for people to complain online. We're also developing paper-based systems that allow organizations to do kind of very tailored direct mail, where they can essentially take any part of what is centrally a website and have any web form turn out to be paper, so they can send. Oh, yeah. So what's happening here is it's analyzing a piece of paper. It looks like a Scantron. But so you can take any part of the website, say, print this out, and then someone can fax it back to a central number that essentially allows it to become a web service. So organizations are beginning to include this in their mailers, in their quarterly newsletters. And one is actually putting one of these in a Penny Saver in Colorado, which is the only newspaper left in many communities across the United States, the Penny Saver. The one that we're farthest along with is called Landman Report Card. This is essentially trying to intervene in people's first interaction with industry, where a landman, who's essentially a professional salesman, comes to your property, tries to encourage you to sign a lease, which gives the companies many rights. And what we found is that people often are kind of have very little information. Most of the information that they can access when they're in this situation is generated by industry. So this is essentially a straight ripoff of Yelp or any other kind of online review site where people can essentially review people within industry. This has got a lot of take up. We've been deploying this very slowly, in part because industry has so much potential to AstroTurf. Does everyone know what AstroTurfing is?
No.
It's fake grassroots activity. So in a typical COGCC public hearing, you might have 20 community members and 500 paid employees of industry will come to basically, they're paid to come and testify at these community hearings. So we know that we're gonna be a huge victim of this. So right now we're trying to develop a system kind of based on Debian. If any of you know Debian, a variant of Linux, which has this very kind of Masonic structure of how developers get involved if they wear robes. So we're trying to develop based on the kind of trust networks that already exist within these communities, to limit access. And so this has been introduced in communities in Ohio and Texas. And so far the communities are using it extensively. And I could show some examples of the sorts of comments that they're writing. We're working heavily with the Berkman Center to try to avoid libel against us and the use of these reports against individuals within the communities. It's a very complicated space. So that's our kind of our structure and our approach. Starting with real social movements that are happening, but they're tremendously underpowered when it comes to the kinds of forces that they're confronting, to try to imagine how do corporations do this, what are the structures that corporations are so successful at doing this with, and then kind of modeling that by creating management roles, reporting roles, simple roles that people throughout the distributed problem can try to play. They're playing already in many cases, but then to aggregate that and turn that into what will hopefully be a national and then a global information communication technology system. I can talk more details about it.
Thanks.
Does anyone have any immediate questions? Come on, I know you do.
You guys all still awake?
Come on. I would love to, Joe, if you want to sort of take a few minutes talking through some of the successful campaigns that have happened on the site. I know you have great stories. So. No, seriously.
Yeah, sure. I should pull up and made some notes on something. There's a lot of interesting
Can I actually also just ask that question?
Sure.
sure it would be nice to know too, like the link between what Ben and Joe do and what Chris is doing seems tenuous, and like we're so much of what we discussed today was how do you get people to buy into something, and then the big question at the end of it is, okay, now what? What's the point? How do you get them to act? And Chris is talking about something that's a project at the level of tactics, and I'm just wondering too if both of you can talk to have any of your projects to get people to sign a petition or join a cause, has it led to some on the ground very physical change, in the way that the real world operates?
Well, I think Ben gave some great examples of that. Probably sort of on the ground change, and actually, one of these things that made me think of is like when we built a petition function, which is really going to get lots and lots of people to sign petitions, and I'd love to work with you guys to get some of your petitions going through our system. And I think what we focused on is trying to provide pretty general purpose tools that folks can, if they're creative and have the tactics to utilize. Like one of our greatest challenges, we have a petition feature that can get petitions that have been run literally like 100,000 a day, but we need to get, we have nonprofits creating petitions, but a lot of nonprofits create kind of crappy petitions. And so, and we have great functionality, but once the petition is done, reporting back to the people who signed the petition, what is the impact then, et cetera. So, as far as kind of some specific examples, I think, a couple I'll talk about. So one that I think is really interesting, which is actually very Harvard-related, is there's a kid named Eric Dane, who is a school at Harvard School of Public Health, sorry, a student at Harvard School of Public Health. And he started a cause really early on about breast cancer research, and certainly benefited from his cause growing like crazy because it was one of the first ones that was started. And when he launched it, there was just a ton of growth, and so he sort of benefited from that. But what's interesting is, in sort of this argument about, moving away from the big brand nonprofits into kind of a more grassroots thing. So it's interesting to look at the evolution of what Eric has done. So he started this cause of breast cancer research, and the nonprofit he chose was not Susan G. Komen, it was not the American Cancer Society, it was Brigham Women's Hospital. Now, you guys living in Boston and affiliated with Harvard know what that is. Most people in the country do not know what Brigham Women's Hospital is. It is not a sort of a well-known brand. It is obviously one of the best hospitals in the country. So Eric makes this very compelling case about how the nurses' health study at Brigham Women's Hospital is the best, largest, longest-running breast cancer study in the world. And then if you care about breast cancer research, this is what you should donate to. So its cause got to literally millions and millions of people within a few months of it being launched. And I remember when Brigham Women's Hospital got our first check, they somehow misinterpreted it and thought that I had given them the check. And so it sent me like an invitation to like a platinum donors dinner, and I sort of really don't understand what's going on here. And so since then, Eric has actually created his own 501c3 called the O Campaign, which has just recently, in the last 12 months, achieved its actual tax-exempt status. So he's gone through the entire process. And now, this is sort of didn't really announce this yet, but he's talked about it publicly, is they want to run the first online cohort study of about breast cancer. He actually wants to use the group that he's built to run a massive cohort study of people affected by breast cancer. And so this is a very tangible, it's not started yet, it's certainly not done yet, but it's a very tangible way for people, and now people can donate to support this study being run on Facebook. Right? It's very, very specific, very tangible. And so this is a great example of moving from a group that sort of just exploded for a couple sort of good, he had a couple good kind of tactical decisions, plus frankly a lot of luck in how it sort of spread virally. And now you happen to have a kid who's had some really good ideas, and now is leveraging that in a really creative way. So I think that's one really great example. Another one I want to talk about is so there's this nonprofit called Alex's Lemonade Stand, which was this girl who died, or folks to also cancer related to fund cancer, had a bunch of kids around the country set up lemonade stands to raise money for cancer. It was a pretty small, kind of very localized operation. They started a cause on Facebook. That cause has gotten really big. They've been really creative in how they've communicated. So one, every week or month, I can't remember, they change the cause photo to be a different specific kid who they're trying to raise money for to do some sort of cancer-related operation. So they're very focused on their storytelling. they have on their own, and with our help a little bit, they brought in Volvo as a corporate sponsor and put up a matching grant. So, you know, matching grants are something that happens all the time, but this creates a much more public way to create that incentive. So we'll put up a $10,000 grant for every dollar donated, they would match that. So that also, and then we also have a feature where individuals can put up their own little private matching grants with their credit cards. So they've gotten a bunch of their members to put up private matching grants. They've done little things like saying if every, you know, because we measure how many people are recruited to the cause, everybody who recruits 25 people gets a t-shirt. And so, you know, little things like that, where they have now, you know, grown this cause to be really, really big, and to have, you know, to raise a lot of money, which, you know, it, obviously raising money is a traditional way to have an impact, but the way that they raise money is still, is very innovative. And, you know, as much as, you know, we like to, you know, talk about, you know, revolutionary ways that impact, I mean, raising money still really matters. And if you, especially obviously, if you can use that money effectively, where being able to raise money matters. And so taking these creative ways to raise money, often for organizations that people have not really heard of, is really interesting. There's another one that I'll throw this out there for Beth, who's in Arkansan. Is that right? Did you say Arkansan? Is that right? There is a cause, which is another, again, I don't know why I keep using cancer examples, like they're pretty popular. This cause, which benefits, I think it's a hospital organization, I can't remember exactly what it is, in Arkansas, has gotten to be 5 million members, which is greater than the population in the state of Arkansas. What is the population of the state of Arkansas?
2.5.
Okay, so yeah, so significantly larger, double the size of the state of Arkansas. And they, you know, they created a fundraising goal around some specific things they were trying to do, you know, and very quickly, you know, hit that goal, and it was like $10,000, a relatively small amount. And they really started to focus their members around, you know, very specific things they've been doing, and, you know, having individuals put up matching grants and things like that. But again, a very, you know, obscure Arkansan nonprofit that sort of, you know, managed to catch on with people for sort of whatever reason. So I think what a lot, and you'll notice a theme to these, which is a lot of the success we've had is about how can you create a narrative, create communication, and create social incentives around, you know, something. I think the type of actions being taken are still not, you know, particularly innovative. A lot of it's donating, some of it is, you know, very, very large petitions. Another one that I like to claim some credit for is the, if you guys read about the garden that the Obamas are planting at the White House. Well, by far the largest public expression about that was a petition to causes, where I forget now the nonprofit, but, you know, trying to, you know, sort of, I guess they call it the new Victory Garden. The Roosevelts during World War II had a Victory Garden in the White House, and this is trying to, you know, have, you know, we can all chip in, we can all grow organic food, everybody can have a garden, and, you know, the White House can set an example, and they put that campaign forward, and, you know, it got hundreds of thousands of signatures on their Facebook petition, which was by far sort of the largest aggregate of people sort of getting involved in this movement, and now the Obamas are, you know, having a garden in the White House. Now, obviously it's not, you know, that controversial, that hard to do to get someone to plant a garden in the White House, but, you know, it is a meaningful symbol, and it's the kind of campaign that's pretty creative, that's not something, you know, you sort of naturally think of. Those are some examples.
I mean, you know, a lot of, I think often for something like causes, also for Avaaz, the most clear wins are when you can engage a global community or national community, a big group of people around a very specific global issue, like what you're describing with the oil wells. And often, like in a sense, local, you know, there's a local conflict. If one side suddenly has like the world on its side, that can kind of, you know, tilt the scales a little bit. Zimbabwe is an area where we've done a lot of different work. And like a lot of problems that Avaaz works on, you know, there's about 15 enormous problems compounded in one really complex system with lots of different factors. But one example of, you know, a sort of mini campaign we ran is after around the time of the election, we were working with a number of Zimbabwean NGOs so that when they were attacked or their offices were raided and people were thrown in prison, we would contact a group of maybe 20,000 people who had been very active in Zimbabwe campaigning, and they would flood Zimbabwean embassies and, you know, police offices and stuff with phone calls and faxes and emails. And, you know, I can't point to a particular person who was freed and say that was because of those people doing that. But I can say that for, you know, if you're a local kind of, you know, Mugabe operative and you've just arrested somebody and then suddenly, like, there's all this, you know, you're getting calls from the embassy asking what's going on, that kind of changes the equation. And there's a whole bunch of things like that that we did. You know, we worked with Zimbabwean Exile Media to air radio ads from, or to air basically radio messages of support from around the world around the holidays when, you know, the word we were getting was that the biggest, among many crises, maybe the biggest one was that people were just generally feeling like giving up hope. Anywhere from that to funding the South African trade unions to create huge banners for a march they did at a regional conference of leaders where they were pressing, well, hopefully pressing both sides, hopefully pressing Mugabe's government to negotiate in better faith. And you know, it's two steps forward, one step back. But there's lots of instances similarly in climate negotiations or lots of different things when we've seen government actors basically shift course after something that they really didn't expect was hit them over the head. And I think that can work best when essentially the kind of you know networked tools empower a local group or an actor that otherwise is kind of in a lonely fight to suddenly have a lot of allies and a lot of support.
And another point, just to add on to the hyper level, we were talking about this before, I think, is that you know sometimes it's easy, you know, I think we're certainly criticized sometimes. It's like, well, you have 50 million people, you've only raised $7 million. Well, A, I think, you know, in like 2 years, that's actually a lot. And so they're like, who the heck are they? They didn't want to donate for us. Like, how do you know we're actually, like, not just stealing the money? And, no, you're not, just say. But, you know, there's a, you know, within those 250,000 causes, there are both really big ones that have achieved a lot, but there are also a lot of really small ones that are, you know, a couple hundred or a couple thousand people, which have, you know, either on a per member basis have raised a lot of money, or, you know, again, that are often on sort of very hyper-localized kind of issue. It's like raising money for someone's college, or it's only just in the development office, and the people, you know, will use it for like their senior gift to kind of like try to raise money for their college, or, you know, things like that, where it is hyper-localized and it's inherently hyper-localized, and it's not like meant to get really big. And I think that, you know, to keep in mind, like, the only metric for CES, not that something getting really big is very powerful, and that's one of the things that these tools can do in a way that was never possible for them. But also, it's also possible to have these very hyper-localized, very small things that never get big and never are meant to. But, you know, big in size, but they have a big impact relative to kind of what they're trying to do.
So we have 7 minutes, and so what I'm gonna do is really quick, I wanna take some final questions and comments, and I'm gonna, hopefully those will snowball into closing comments, and we can have you guys respond to any questions or add final comments. And I'll just start off with a few that I think are sort of themes we've seen throughout the day. So, and not everyone has said every one of these, but a number of these have been said by various people. Online spaces are no different than real spaces. Some disagreement about that, but that was also consensus around it. The story matters for movements, and the same thing is true online. Online space does not necessarily give you a story, but it gives you tools to make a good story if you have one, or to tell a good story about it. It's not enough to get people to sign on or to click, but rather there are two stages to getting them involved and moving them forward, which is one, a narrative identity stage, with buy-in, and then two, a strategy stage where there's a question about what happens next. And maybe those two, like Chris's work makes me think those two might be reversed, because you need to have the strategy to make the network salient so that a story can actually be told that is the story. And then action can happen after that. A lot of consensus that we need much more work on the strategy side of things. The stories seem to be big and flashy, but Ben noted that we're telling a lot of the same stories over and over again and not moving forward in terms of political action. Joe mentioned this idea that social space is occurring online the same way it did in the physical space, and we're just discovering how these social dynamics work online. Maybe they're the same, maybe they're not, but it's understanding those dynamics that's going to get us to understand how action happens. And then finally, I wish Ethan Zuckerman were here. He was supposed to be here, but he's having trouble with his eyes. He's currently obsessed with homophily. And without the word cropping up so much, everyone seemed to mention it in one form or another. And it seemed that some people thought it was a really good thing. It was good for their organization, good for their cause. And other people thought it was really troubling. And I've only heard it in a negative way. negative context, and it sounded like for some organizations it's actually really great. Like Ben said, we can get a critical mass around a particular issue and have this space for people who are interested in that issue, and they can build off of each other and grow, and then Thomas said, yeah, and so can terrorists, which is a concern for people who are studying radicalization. But that's just my list, and it's by no means complete. Colin had a few comments, and then we'll just go around the room and end things with the panel.
Thank you. So those are great points. I just want to basically restate those, I suspect, but add a few pointed questions. So for me, I feel like this is the meta question that we always address or try to address, and that we did a great job of beginning to bite off today, is so what happens when real meets virtual? What do their kids look like? What's this kind of, what is this thing that we've created? What are the limits to what we can do in the virtual space? How much of those limits are imposed by what we've been doing in the real space and our ways of thinking about the virtual space? So raising money, collecting signatures, those are things that came very familiar to us. We've always done that, we're doing that now. At some point, however, the massive petition, because it's so easy to collect, whereas it was so hard to collect before, is no longer going to be of value, right? The reason that your congressperson listens to your letter is because you had to walk down to the post office and, you know, send your letter. When you can send an email to 1,000, you know, folks, that's not the same sort of value anymore. So at some point, or maybe it's already begun to happen, our old ways of doing things are not so meaningful in this new world. And I think the trick is that in all these examples to begin to peel apart the different stories and to go deeper and figure out when are they meaningful, when are they not, when does the mediation that we're seeing change things, and when does it, and in which direction does it change it? And so the way I would break that down further is, say, is to ask, what does it mean for individuals? So how do we develop new narratives and approaches to leadership that leverage the net? Going back to what Marshall said, there's sort of a bottom-upness to the net, which is really exciting, but that also has its limits. And how do we rethink about sort of what we know in the organizing world of old versus what we're seeing in the net world of new, and kind of figure out what's the leadership metaphor going forward, given that all folks agreed that was so important? And you could say something similar about narrative. Another question for individuals is, how do you sift through all this information and all these different needs? How do you direct me to what I want to do with my scarce time and my scarce attention? Increasingly, right, our attention is our most scarce resource, and what happens when I can join one of 10,000 causes or 10 million or however many? As Marshall was saying, again, you know, Dr. King says we're focusing on the buses. But now what we've just heard from Ben is that we're going to offer a Chinese menu of whatever cause you want. We're going to hook you up with some way to put your energy. Both seem, you know, I can understand both of them, but where do those kind of come together? And then for me, the big question is what it means for organizations. We heard, I won't say bashing, but observations about the challenge to traditional advocacy organizations, who shall remain nameless, but I have experienced this myself also, in adjusting to the internet and figuring out how to leverage this, right? You can go to Blue State Digital and buy a package, buy consulting, buy whatever you want, but if your organization doesn't get it at the core, what the internet is and kind of the net culture, and I can guarantee you if you go to the websites, right, they still have all of their great research reports copyrighted, right? They're not sharing them. They're not open sourcing them. They're not putting them under Creative Commons licenses. You know, there's a million things that they're doing in the old ways. They're controlling things. And so are they ever going to get this new space? Are those organizations going to go the way of newspapers that we've seen? Is there going to be a reinvention? And, you know, ultimately my question is, what's organizing and advocacy 2.0 or 3.0 or whatever the next 0.0 is going to look like?
Listening to you, it's pretty overwhelming. You've got all kinds of wonderful things on the table. I'm seeing you as a smorgasbord, and I'm wondering if I don't know too much about this. I want to put my toe in the pond here, and I want to become a facilitator for some cause, right? I go to you for instant, quick communication type tools, and I go to somebody else for something else to leverage all this stuff as best I can, but always from my needs point of view. And I think, you know how the new way to business is like, you don't think of a big business anymore, you think of project teams that can move quickly and And basically, they come together for some reason, and then they disperse when they're done. And they come together, and they pull the different tools together, and see their they see their project to its completion, and then they disband and move on to something else. Well, you're all creating yourselves as entities that are going to stick around and do your thing. But it's how do you pull it together from my point of view on the ground? Just leveraging what, I mean, I don't want to have to, like you said, waste all my time. I'm not going to live forever. How do I do it quickly and get my fingers on it really quickly and not get all, you know, distracted by 10 million choices out there, 10 million jelly beans of what I can pull into my basket to do what I want to do?
Thank you for the discussion. Again, Lee, I'm from Harvard Law School. I'm from Harvard Law School, Leading Scholars. I'm also environmentalist in Taiwan. I can quick share my experience, just a quick reaction to this gentleman's discussion. What comes to us is I led a social movement last year to against the highway construction in Taiwan, and we raised 120,000 online petition in 6 months, and we have very good media exposure. And we put this agenda into our presidential election debate. So, but for us, the question is, what's next? How can we use those the network community that we built to really stop this this construction? So then we have to think of that. How can we use this network? And we the model we use that we build a database that can concluding the fact sheet about all the construction details and some very beautiful photos that this highway is going to destruct. And we mail to those professional in this community, like the director, like the professional editor, and ask them if you can do a brochure for us, if you can do a documentary for us, maybe animation film for us, and what do you need? And we can provide all the material you need. So for them, it was very small and easy step to do this kind of stuff. And then we want to doubt the environmental impact statement of this highway construction. And we asked the volunteers in the graduate in 20 graduate school students to join us, our research team, to find out the truth that the bias existing in the environmental impact statement. And finally, that we reject this construction in the end. So what my point is, the question is not really the number is, but how you really use this network. And my question, I have two questions. One is that like the community we have built for years, that was very purposeful to against this highway construction. But what next? If we really stop this highway, so what next? What can this community do? If we can't keep this community work, it will be a big waste. And I need your opinion about this issue. And the second question is that how can we let the donor monitor their money? Where are they going? Can we develop some kind of evaluating system like eBay that I can trace my donation money and see if it's worked and see if I want to donate again? Yeah.
My name is Mark Kendall.
Just a quick note, we're already over time, so thank you.
I'm going to be very happy to be in. So, my question is for the campaign, because it's very impressive to me to be the social movement in the past. It's really a good case. The promotion of social movement and social network and the partner up force. To me, it's kind of social innovation. It's very, but I was a little worried about some charge of the art because the help of the abbot is like to close the gap in what we have and what we want. Most people have the real heart. It's easy to say, but it's really crucial. What's exactly the most people in the way they want? So, about because some of the action is very critical, and to me it's very dependent on the judgment. as a principal judgment and critical understanding. So I want to ask if the question is how the initiative, the action, is proposed, how to avoid the risk of the make one decision without a domestic negative impact that you are able to do as much as the possible one you are able to do. The second question is connected to how to manage the challenge of in the social network society. If the view of the value, the views and the values of the world of people has already been misleading by the political life and the control population. So the result is that if the people has been misleading, so what they thought, probably it's not great.
Probably we should continue the discussion after the event ends. But those are both exactly the right questions that we strive. We have a bunch of systems in place to try to answer them, but ultimately it's always imperfect. So look forward to discussing more.
I wanted to make maybe a comment on the point about sort of the once you lower the barrier to entry, does the effects get lower as well? And it's an interesting one, right? It's like, you know, if you look specifically like lobbying Congress people, there's this sort of continuum from the harder the thing is to do, presumably the more it's valued, right? So like somebody coming into the person's office in person, then a phone call or a handwritten letter, then like a personal email, like an individualized email.
Telegram.
A telegram, if you're like, you know, saying something around the Bird's office. Maybe sort of use like a pony thing. And then, you know, finally at the bottom would be sort of like selling. So the question is, you know, because these, you know, many of these things are easier to do, does it make their effect less? And I think, I don't think that has to be the case. I think it's been the case. I think that, you know, it's not a zero-sum game, right? There's not like a certain amount of influence that you had and you're sort of dividing it up. I think that there is a lot of opinions that people have gone unexpressed. And like a lot of the things that you guys are working on are sort of commonly held opinions that just haven't really gotten expressed. So the question is, you know, ultimately, you know, when you're trying to influence politicians, like, are they convinced that it's a voting issue? Like, ultimately, like, do you care enough that come election time, you're going to vote against them because of this issue? And so I think you could express that in a lot of different ways. I think there's a lot of room and a lot of very interesting things that you'll see happening in the coming years where, you know, sort of online creative interest groups have kind of vote pooling and have various ways to say, okay, like, you know, this DARPA group, these 5 million people are not going to vote for you because of this issue. You can make that very, very concrete. And I don't know what exact sort of form it will take, whether it's a petition or a phone call or whatever, but I think that there's a lot of possibility there. And I think it's a problem we'll have. I mean, I think a theme of this whole day that has been, this question of what next, right? You've got all these people together, and you know, this may be sobering, but the question of what next is a really hard question. Like, the Obama folks, sort of, you know, some of the most, you know, ostensibly accomplished people in this space recently, you know, they're creating this Organizing for America campaign. They don't really know what's next. Like, it hasn't really done much yet. So, you know, they don't know what's next. A lot of people don't know what's next. It's really hard to do, to figure out what's next. And so hopefully these tools give a lot more people the ability to ask the question. In other words, a lot more people have an organization now to ask the question, what's next? So hopefully by having more people doing it, you have more people, and therefore someone will come up with a good answer. And it's sort of more likely that more people will listen.
We got to wrap up. But, thanks again to you guys, and thanks for everyone for sticking around. It's a long day, but a fruitful discussion.